Reengage is a Bible study that will begin August 20th for couples of all stages and all ages. We hope that healthy married couples are in there, and if you need help in your marriage, you're one of those who looks at your husband or you look at your wife and say, we're a joke, just like the couple did a moment ago, this is for you as well. In fact, this 12-week Bible study will begin meeting on the 20th of August on Sunday morning 9:30, and you'll be doing so for 12 weeks, and you'll be paired with a marriage mentor couple. So we expect a good number of people in there, be ongoing, should be an excellent opportunity. Now, before I get going in this message, a lot of men ask me the following question. Let me just affirm it. Yes, your wife did help me write today's marriage sermon, okay? So we've been going through your email and your mail, and we really got you figured out. In fact, in today's marriage series, we're looking forward to a time together in Mark chapter 10. So if you've got a Bible, go ahead and turn there with me. 10th chapter of Mark for the second week in a row. Let me point ahead one Sunday from today where we'll have a number of marriage counselors free to you beginning around 9 o'clock Sunday morning till a little after this worship service. If you need somebody to speak with, you go by the Encourage Room. It's absolutely free. Your generosity to our church budget allows us to do that. We want to help your marriage. Look at me for just a moment. There are no perfect marriages. So if next Sunday you get here and you think, do I really need to go in that room and talk to somebody? What if everybody else comes? There are no perfect marriages, okay? So you take advantage of that help. Mark chapter 10, we're looking at this question, what happens if my feelings change? You know, as I said to you a Sunday ago, my wife has been married to at least 5 different people, and all of them have been me. Your feelings are going to change in marriage. So what happens when my feelings do change? We come together for romance. We come together for sexual intimacy. But we come together for sanctuary, for someone to live life with. And the remarkable aspect of marriage is that throughout that time and the ebbs and flows, we're going to see different seasons of that. And today I want to look at that. Let me just help you understand sort of a series overview where we've gone and where we're going. A week ago we looked at this question, does marriage matter anymore? You can go back to our website and click on that. We learned that sociological studies are telling us marriage does matter. It marries for men. It matters. It matters for men. It matters for women, and we're going to see in the weeks to come, it really does matter even for children. You can see in the weeks to come, if you're single, we've even got a sermon for you. Help, I'm single and my pastor's doing a marriage series. So we're gonna cover all the bases. We're going to look at how to fight well, how to communicate when we don't get along, and what's the secret to happily ever after. Now, as we talk about today, this possibility of two people staying in love. We know that when two become one, but can to remain one. So I need you to focus with me for just a minute. I need you to ask yourself a question. So I don't know what it looks like for you to get focused. I don't know if that's closing your eyes, bowing your head. You can look straight at me, whatever you need to do. But I want to ask this question to you. In a day and age when people are really cynical about love lasting for a lifetime, do you feel like happily ever after is a possibility for you? Do you have hope? Do you think your marriage or your future marriage can stay together? You need to fundamentally ask yourself that question. For so many, including millennials, pessimism, cynicism has crept in and said the answer is no. And so many of them are moving from one relationship to another. Here's where we're going to go today. I want to help you answer that question and give you some of the tools to help you achieve two people remaining one flesh for a lifetime. Here's our goal today. Our goal is not just happy marriage, but our goal is a Christian marriage. Here's how I'm defining what a Christian marriage would look like, how it would benefit our community and our church. A Christian marriage is the permanent union of two born-again people of the opposite sex. It's the permanent union of two born-again people. Why do I say born-again? Because the Bible says, Jesus says, people are born physically, but only some people are born again spiritually. You come to Jesus Christ, he changes your life through the cross of Jesus. Two born-again people of the opposite sex coming together for the purpose of radical oneness. When marriage is discussed in the New Testament, it is often laid right alongside the Trinity. God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit are radically one. Husband and wife can be radically one. And they come together for the purpose of encouraging and equipping one another for the time when each appear before Jesus. 1995, my wife stood next to me. We exchanged vows. But the Bible, Jesus says, there's a day coming when she and I will spend eternity with him and we'll no longer be married. Married is for this lifetime only. So my role in her life is to encourage and equip her as I hand her to Jesus one day. And her role in my life is to encourage and equip me as she hands me to Jesus one day. That's the definition of a distinctly Christian marriage. Mark chapter 10. We're looking at Jesus' teaching. You're going to notice that if you're really paying attention to your Bible, you'll see this in Matthew 19 as well as Luke 16. But here in Mark chapter 10 for the second week in a row, let's dig in. Beginning in verse 1, and Jesus left there and went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan, and crowds gathered to him again. And again, as was his custom, he taught them. And the Pharisees came up, and in order to test him, asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" He answered them, "What did Moses command you?" And they said, "Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce and to send her away." And Jesus said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Therefore, man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become what?" Say it. "And the two shall become..." That's weak. That is, it's a few weeks from school and my mind's not engaged. "And the two shall become..."
One.
That's much better. "What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." And in the house, the disciples asked him again about this matter. And he said to them, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery." May God bless the reading of his word. Now, what we just read is recorded in at least three gospels. And let me sort of give you a synopsis of sort of the narrative and the discussion. In verse 2, Jesus is asked a question by the Pharisees. But you'll notice in verse 2, the Bible says they ask the question not for information, but they're asking the question to test Jesus. So in verse 3, Jesus responds. But I want you to see probably what's going on with the Pharisees. Do you remember Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist? Do you remember how he died? It was not a pleasant death. He has not buried someone near the Jordan desert. In fact, he was beheaded. Why? Because he spoke against the marriage of Herod. Herod had married a woman who had left her husband and married him. No doubt the Pharisees are sort of trying to goad Jesus or push Jesus towards saying this very same thing that Herod did, trying to get Jesus killed. So Jesus responds in verse 3 by saying, "What does the Bible say?" You'll notice that they come back with a reply. Therefore, they speak in verse 4, a parable, or I should say a paraphrase of the Bible. And then in verses 5 through 9, Jesus lays out a significant, eye-opening, radical teaching with regard to marriage. So much so, it's how radical is it? So much so that in verse 10, when the disciples gather again later, they have to ask, "Did you really mean that? Can you unpack that?" Now, you'll notice the bluntness of Jesus. We'll return to that in just a moment. By the way, you don't have to be around Jesus very long before he'll insult you. And he really insults you in verse 10 and 11 and 12, does he not? I mean, he just lays it out there, maybe like your grandfather or your dad did. You're afraid to bring people over. We're going to go on that in just a minute. But look at this. What God has joined together, listen carefully, what God has joined together, God can keep together. Do you believe that? What God has joined together, can you say that with me? What God has joined together, God can keep together. High school students, you're just a few weeks away from having your minds engaged, your pencils up. Can you say that with me? Just high school students alone, I'm looking right at you. I love you in the name of Jesus. What God has joined together, God can keep together. Well, you guys are almost there. You're almost in form. I want to look at three levels with you, three lines, all coming from Mark chapter 10. First, I want you to see that the Bible's calling upon us to work for oneness in marriage. We're to work for oneness in marriage. Return back to verses 7 and 8 again, where the Bible calls upon us here to leave father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Here's our question. What happens when my feelings change? Some of you who are romantically, you're dating, or you're pretty new to marriage, it may come as a shock that your feelings are going to change. Everybody's feelings change with regard to their partner. I remember the first really good car I had was a 1990 Chevrolet Beretta. It was white. It was two-door. No doubt it was part of the reason my wife was attracted to me back in those days. And when I got it, I had it in the garage, and noted I was on the floor of the garage with brushes, toothbrushes, and, you know, rags and everything, taking off the stuff at the very bottom near the wheel wells. Now, fast forward 10 years later, Tracy and I are now married. That car did not receive that attention. In fact, toward the end of my selling that vehicle, you could have found fries pretty much from every nearby fast food place back there. What happened? Well, my feelings had changed toward the car. Now, unlike a car, a marriage cannot or should not be traded in once your feelings have changed for that. You've heard me say, and I stole it from somebody else, that my wife has been married to at least five men, all of them been me. I am now 46. I was married at 23. I have been married almost half my life. My likes are not the same as they were at 23. I'm a different person than I was then. So when two people exchange their vows, their feelings are going to change. And here's one of the secrets with regard to marriage. Marriage, if a marriage is going to operate as like guerrilla warfare up against the selfishness of those who are married, marriage is going to operate like guerrilla warfare up against those who are selfish in a marriage. And we're all selfish. We all are. My wife does things that drives me nuts. I do twice as many things that drive her nuts. I am not mechanically inclined. My father was a mechanical engineer. Those genes did not get passed down to me. But she will look at things that I have put together and shake her head. She can just see it as it comes together. She's much better at that than I am. But she does things likely to drive me crazy. In every yard that we've owned, my wife has a desire to have a lot of plants and a lot of flowers. You say, well, that's great. Pastor, what's wrong with flowers and plants? Well, the problem is when you plant them in the grass. Because when you do that, it requires more weed eating, and it requires a differentiation between that which is a flower and that which is a weed and that which is grass. And my eye can't distinguish between those things. And I've done some stupid things in marriage. Early marriage, there have been times I just, you know, accidentally, intentionally took the weeder through that and got rid of that. Said, oh, I didn't know. That was the first few years. I'm smarter now, much smarter about those things now. But those are one of those things that just drives you crazy. Now, no matter who you marry, no matter how good-looking she is, or no matter, you know, if he's 65 and got the six-pack abs, no matter who you marry, you are selfish, and that individual is going to grate on your nerves. Again, I repeat for you that every marriage is going to act like a 5-ton Mack truck over the bridge over your life. And what is that? That 5-ton Mack truck shows the fractures, it shows the fissures in your personality and your character, the selfish aspects to it. And it's not until you come to grips with that that you understand how to really be successful in marriage. See, those fractures, those fissures were there prior to your marriage. Your parents may have told you about them, maybe your boss told you about them. Maybe your college roommates told you about them or others, but you ignored them. It's only when the radical intimacy of marriage does your selfishness really collide up against somebody else, your irritability. So here's one of the things to a successful marriage. If you're going to have this one flesh union that Jesus speaks about in verses 5, 6, and 7, here's one of the things. two people have to be willing to work on themselves. That's worthy of writing down. Matter of fact, if you brought her here to hear this sermon, if you brought him here to hear this sermon, if you're saying, Scott, sick him, that is one of the statements. See, I told you he was going to talk to you. You both must be willing to work on yourself. But here's what happens. Now, most of you wives, if you hang with us husbands, you give us 10 years, it's going to be worth it. Because the stupidity and the arrogance of the first 10 years of my marriage, I tend to smarten up and realize, oh, my wife told me that. I should have been listening to her. Most of us men, we are full of ourselves. In fact, maybe in this series, I'm going to talk about bringing the humble pill and you taking that humble pill and realizing you're not all that you think that you are. And the radical aspect of working on yourself. Marriage does that. Jesus calls upon us to work for oneness in our marriage, and your feelings for your spouse will change no matter who you are, no matter who you marry. If you believe in the myth of this special person, if I only married this right person, if I get rid of this person and get the right person, then all this will go away. That is a myth. They put that on the Hallmark Channel for women on Saturday afternoon to torment their husbands with on the rest of the weekend. That is not true. There is not a perfect person out there for you that will present you no challenges. You're going to have to work for oneness in your marriage. Let me give you a couple of marriage no-nos, just some practical things to buttress your marriage. First, here's some things. If you really want to be stupid in marriage, speak negatively about your spouse to others. If you want to ruin your marriage, speak negatively about your spouse to others. If you want to be stupid times two, speak negatively about your spouse to your mother. She will never forget what your wife did wrong. She will never forget what your husband did wrong. And she told you that she was not and he was not worthy of marrying you in the first place. In fact, you should never speak negatively about your spouse. If you're struggling in marriage, you find one person that you can speak to with confidence. Someone of the same sex, another man. And you never criticize. Never criticize. If you listen to my messages when I was an early pastor to now, I've learned a great lesson. All the negative stories I tell are about me. Very rarely will you hear a negative story about Tracy. Because I'm to never criticize my spouse to others. Here's a second. If you want to be really stupid in marriage, keep secrets from one another. If you really want to be a temporary marriage, if you don't want a wedding, permanent wedding, like a wedding lease, you want to do a wedding lease, keep secrets from one another. You should never, never, never keep secrets. See, a secret is nothing more than a brick to create a wall between you and your partner. So what do I mean by that? There should be no secret friends. There should be no secret texts. There should be no secret cell phones. There should be no secret social media. There should be no secret money. There should be no secret lifestyle. If you or your partner have a secret telephone pointing to my nose like a bloodhound, that tells you something's really bad going on. You know what I do with my cell phone? This is my passcode. These are my passwords. Anything that I have on this phone is yours. That's what it meant when we got married together. Every one of you, if you want a healthy marriage, you don't keep secrets from one another. Here's a third way to be really stupid in marriage. Flirt with somebody other than your spouse. You know what flirting is? Flirting is warming my hands at a campfire built for my ego. Like me going down the street, showing off my, which way to the beach kind of thing. Look how good looking I am. You never, never, never flirt with anybody else. You should flirt with your spouse. But you should never flirt with somebody else at work, at the gym. We need to return back to old-fashioned standards of how to interact with the opposite sex. Here's another one. Here's another stupid thing you can do in your marriage. Give more attention to your technology than your married partner. Now, in all the services, you should see the women's heads turned toward their husbands. So let's look right here. Keep your focus right. Keep the elbows in. None of that. We don't need that right there. Okay? Chicken wings go someplace else. Now, what do I mean by that? Now, I get it. Let me just speak to men for just a minute. I am a sports fan, and you've heard me tell the story. I took Tracy years ago. We got away, went to Denver, saw my favorite NFL team play at Denver. And we're there. It's at the end of the fourth quarter. It's very cold. It's 17-17. The Broncos are driving to win the game, like a minute to go in the fourth quarter. And she looks at me and she says, "I'm so cold. Can we go?" And I said, "Well, you can go, but I'm going to stay here and watch this game." Now, wives that don't get sports will do that from time to time. They will speak in the middle of the game. Now, most of you have a DVR. So you press pause, and then you take your face and you put it on your wife. Because you know what? Your wife matters more than who wins that game. That's the truth. When you get home, you take that cell phone and you put it down. You don't need to be on it all evening. Some of you need rules. Parents, you need to have rules with regard to that cell phone. Shouldn't go upstairs. Should get that thing away. That's for another sermon of the time. But give your partner more attention than your technology. Here's another one. Here's the last marriage no-no if you're going to be working for oneness. It's this. Don't be verbally or physically abusive. Sometimes in marriage, I don't know what it is about love, and we're passionate with one another, but they elicit such a strong reaction in us that we could say words that we wouldn't say to our boss, to our teachers, or our classmates, to anybody else. And we've hurled insults at them. In fact, what you do when you ratchet up the rhetoric at that way, you might as well take a chisel, might as well take a hammer, and get you a stone and chisel that word out, what you called him, what you called her, because it will stick with him. How do I know that? Because I remember some of the things my parents said almost 30 plus years ago. Everybody loses their temper. Everybody's going to be angry at one another. But you need to have a restraint on your mouth. Sometimes you need to walk away, need to leave the room. I should say this. You should never put your hands. You should never physically hurt your spouse. You do not put your hands on him in that way. You never put your hands on her in that way. You don't restrain her. You don't restrain, push them back. For those of you who are the stronger sex, men, you are cowardly if you're physically abusing your wife or anyone else in your house. And if you're being physically abused, you should reach out and get help. There are people who would love to help you in that. Those are marriage no-nos. You and I are going to work to achieve oneness in marriage. Look at the secondly, going back to our text. Jesus does recognize, though, that when two become one, one can now become two. Let's look back at our text for just a moment. Let's re-engage for just a moment, understand what Jesus is doing. Notice that Jesus is asked a question. Let's move through it again in verse 2. Jesus responds by essentially what does the Bible say? Here's his question. They're wanting to know, when is it right to get a divorce in God's eyes? Jesus was teaching in a time when essentially it was a no-fault divorce, much like ours. The Jewish people, the Roman people felt almost 100% to a no-fault divorce. So Jesus asks what the Bible says. They go to their go-to text in verse 3, Deuteronomy 24, verse 1. It's the only passage in the Old Testament that regulates divorce. Jesus gives a comment on that in verse 4. You'll notice he says, it's because of the hardness of heart that Moses gave you permission. It's actually in verse 5 where he says that. And then Jesus responds to their citing of Deuteronomy 24 with his own. And look at verses 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. When Jesus calls upon us, he says, the two shall remain one flesh. What God has joined together, let not man separate. And then look at verse 11. Whoever divorces his wife, marries another, commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Now, Jesus can insult you like nobody else. He is blunt. He is inconvenient in his teaching. And essentially what Jesus does here is that most of the divorces in his day, he calls adultery. And most of the divorces, what Jesus calls in our day, he would call adultery. He is blunt. He is, for some people, insulting. They'll walk away from him. Many Americans hold their nose when it comes to the Bible's teaching on marriage and sex and just pick the other parts out. Now, Jesus repeats this statement. He repeats it in Luke chapter 16. He repeats it in Matthew chapter 5. But the one I want you to see is in Matthew chapter 19, verse 9. Here Jesus says, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. What's he getting at here? Now, you could see that he's sort of added an aspect to it. Here's what he's moving at. The word sexual morality, your translation may translate that the word adultery, but the word is porneia. That's the Greek word. Porneia, can you hear that word in English? What would that be on the front end of? Pornography. So you can see that Jesus is saying if your partner is involved in some level of sexual immorality, could be adultery, you have Jesus' permission to divorce. You don't have to divorce. You can forgive. In fact, there's a prophet named Hosea whom God commands to go and marry his prostitute wife. God does not demand that you get rid of a sexually unfaithful spouse. That's why he died on the cross, so that we forgive one another, have the power to do that. But Jesus does give permission. Now, I should say that Paul speaks about divorce and gives a second exclusion in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and 8, but that's for another time. Again, you get the really radical aspect of Jesus. He's restricting divorce. And Jesus is the most compassionate teacher you'll ever meet, but he's also one of the most blunt. And he'll stand in front of a group of people like he did those disciples and Pharisees and just call them adulterers and keep on moving. Some of you hate divorce as much as God hates divorce. And my point today is not to take this text and beat you over the head with it. Truthfully, sometimes divorce is the option. And I've advised people through the years because of this passage, if he won't or she won't stop, then you've got to remove yourself from that place. I want you to see that for most of us today, our marriages, God is calling us to forgive, to stick with it, and to endure. I'll come on that in a moment, but let me speak a word of grace. You may not know, there's a man named David. He lived about 1,000 years before Jesus. King David of Israel had found a woman named Bathsheba. Look at what God does here. David finds Bathsheba. She's bathing on a rooftop. He sees her without clothing. She's very attractive. She's very young. He calls for her to come over to the king's palace. They consummate the relationship. David realizes that he's in trouble when she's pregnant. Her husband Uriah is far off in battle. So therefore, Uriah knows it's not his child. David calls him back, tries to get him to lay with his wife. He won't. He lays on the doorstep of his house, on the welcome mat, if you will, because he says, why should I lay in my bed with my wife when the rest of my men are soldiering out there? And David is left with no choice, and he murders Uriah. Now, what do you think God thinks of that? Well, he sends a man named Nathan, who's a prophet, kind of like a guy like me. Nathan puts his finger in David's face and says, you are guilty. Now, you'd think that the king, you'd think that the president would push back, but David melts like snow on a July 4th. And he says, you're right. I'm wrong. And he repents. What happens from there? What does God do? Does God just send lightning bolt after another? No, he takes the product of that relationship, David and Bathsheba, and intentionally places that in the family of Jesus. Read about it in Matthew chapter 1 and Luke chapter 3. God can take the mess of your relationship and do something amazing and graceful with it. He can do something beautiful with it. But let me Let me pause here for just a moment and just sort of sit on this teaching of Jesus. Let's not move. Let's build a campfire here. There are some hearing this today, and they say, oh, God will forgive, and I'm just going to leave this partner because she doesn't make me happy, and I'm going to go on to somebody else. My father was a Navy CB. He was the product of the Pittsburgh Steel Mills. And at times in my life when I decided to take him on verbally, he did not let me down. If I said, hey, I want to fight, not a physical fight, you know, like child, you know, let's see if you're going to stand behind this one, he would not let me down. If I smarted off to him or my mother, he made sure he'd circle the wagons and come back and say, we will not do that here. I tell you that because when you sin against God with intentionality, with premeditation, you say, oh, this is no big deal. God is going to forgive. You're sinning with a high hand. And God is a good God. And what does a good God do? God is a good judge. And some of you, when you do that, he will take you, Hebrews chapter 12, and he will discipline you. And if he doesn't discipline you, that's even scarier than if he did discipline you. What does it mean if he doesn't discipline you? It means you're not his child. And may I just say to you as your pastor and as your shepherd, if you intentionally go into sin and say God will forgive, boy, I don't know what you're about with the cross of Jesus. Because as I understand that cross and understand I did that to him, I've sinned with the frequency and intensity as much as anybody else in this room. But God forbid if I'd say, you know what, I'm just going to do it, no big deal, he will forgive. That's sinning with a high hand, and you need to be very careful and tread lightly and look at your heart. David repented. He repented. Here's the third thing in this text I want you to see. I want you to see this lastly. The Bible calls upon this. It speaks to us here in a remarkable way. The hard heart is an enemy of marriage. The hard heart is an enemy of marriage. Look at verse 5. Because of the hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. The simple truth is, if divorce is present, there's sin, and there's sin on both sides. Because the hard heart is an enemy of marriage. What do I mean by that? When you are married and you think the problem is her and you think the problem is him, Jesus is saying the problem is your heart. I want to go to the notes because I want to make sure I read this accurately. Your hard heart, your selfishness, your lack of willingness to work on yourself, that 5-ton truck of marriage when it comes over the bridge of your life and you just put your head in the sand and say, I refuse to work on me, here's what I want you to hear. What's in you will come out. What's in you will come out of you no matter who's with you. What's in you will come out of you no matter who's with you. What do I mean? If the problems I'm having right now and I trade partners, I'm going to find what's in me is going to come out no matter who's with me. My hard heart, my selfishness, my lack of willing to work on myself. When she says, I'm going to kill you when you, and I say, you know what? I've had it. I'm trading. And come 5 years later when the newness is worn off, lo and behold, what was in me has come out, no matter who's with me. Those of you who know yourself well, haven't you had this moment like I've had? Scott, you disgust me. I cannot believe you'd think that, do that, not put them first. Have you never thought that? Have you never said that to yourself? Have you never looked in the mirror and had an honest appraisal at some point in your life? If you haven't, then you don't know yourself very well. The challenge here is the hard heart. Let me give you a couple more marriage no-nos. Just some practical things. First, if you want to kill your marriage, have intimate conversations with someone of the opposite sex. Emotional intimacy is the ramp to adultery. I never engage in a conversation with somebody of the opposite sex about an emotionally intimate thing. That's just not the place to do it. I can talk about it with one or two friends, and most of you are way too free even with that information. You clamp it down. You don't post it on social media. It doesn't need to be on Instagram or Tinder or any of those crazy things. you need to have one or two good friends that you tell it, and it's never the person the opposite sex. If you want to kill your marriage, here's another marriage no-no. Sleep with someone other than your spouse. If you're married to somebody who says, you just need to forgive me, and I'm sorry, and they do it again, and they do it again, they're habitually committing adultery on you, you need to hear your pastor, put your foot down. Stop it. I'm not going to tolerate this behavior. You're not going to sleep with everybody and always come back here. You may forgive it, and you may forgive it, and I believe that God commands you to forgive and will give you the power to forgive, but at some point, they're walking all over you, and divorce is a real option. Here's another no-no. Parenting your spouse. We tell jokes. You know, we have three kids. Tracy's raising four people, you know. And it's true. I'd say, you know, for multiple years, she did teach me a lot of things. But the moment you get married, you have a license and a responsibility. Here's a new word that millennials are teaching me, to adult. To adult. You take your responsibility seriously. She's not raising you. You're not raising her. You don't parent them. Here's great information, great counsel from my friend Kevin Thompson. He says, when your dog and your husband run away, when your dog and your wife run away, don't chase after either one of them. The moment you chase after your dog will keep running away. The moment that your husband and your wife keeps running away and you keep running after them, you're only enabling that. You don't need another child. You need an adult. And if you parent that spouse, you're only enabling that terrible behavior. Here's another no-no. Put your foot down. Be married to a practicing addict. I'm talking about prescription or non-prescription drugs or alcohol. You're saying, Pastor, should I divorce them? No, I'm saying you put your foot down and say, this is not happening in this home to the best of my ability. Some of you are involved with alcohol, and it is a ramp to physical abuse and all types of illicit, terrible behaviors. Put your foot down when practicing, being married to a practicing addict. And here's the last one that may shock you to some of you. Remaining married with somebody who needs to find a job but is not seeking a job. If he or she is able to work and you need the income and you're not like 65 and older, in the name of Jesus, go get a job. If you're married to somebody that thinks work is a four-letter word, you need to educate them. I have been home sick. There is nothing good on television during the day. Nothing. Get out of the house and get after it. Don't remain with somebody. Put your foot down. Get some intervention. Get counseling if they're not seeking a job. When we think about marriage, in conclusion, marriage is not about the feelings. You know this. Tomorrow morning, I may not feel like getting up and going to work, but I will go to work, won't I? I've got a house that needs paid for, so I'll go to work. I don't always live by my feelings. What happens when my feelings change? Love and marriage. Marriage is not based primarily on love. Love is an emotion, but it's also a commitment and an action. Let me finish with this. The way you dissolve a marriage at the very end is you undo the marriage vows. The marriage vows are the things that you say, till death do us part. You know what keeps a marriage together? It's not love. It's those vows. The vows keep the marriage together. And when you remain together, even in the difficult days, you're going to find that when you act loving and do loving, then the feelings will eventually come back. Yes, it's going to take two people willing to work. Yes, it's very important who you choose to marry. Many of you will bring somebody home that your parents were going to say, are you crazy? And you've got that rebellion in you because you're young, and off you go. And then you get wise and you say, what did I do? It's so important that you choose character ahead of looks in your future space partner. It's so important that you choose character ahead of looks in your future partner. It's so important that you choose character before looks in your future partner. Do I need to say that again? It is so important that you choose character before looks and your future partner. Look what Tracy did. She didn't get the one, maybe, right? Your feelings will change. Love and liking him or her will come and go. But when you make those vows and you remain together, your goal and my goal, for those of you who are married or soon to be married or those of you who want to be married, you know what it is? I said, I have a friend. I have a partner that I've done life with. And down the way, when she and I are in a nursing home together or we're walking down our hall, down our, you know, our house with two feeble walking, you know, what are those? I can't think of the name of those right now. Walkers. And she says, she didn't marry for intelligence either. And she and I are sharing those stories. Do you remember how poor we were? And you remember this? And I look at my kids and I watch them and I think down, you know, 30 years from now, I think, they're doing, those boys are doing the very stupid thing I did. And I want you to call them and get them over here because they're emulating the stupid arrogance of their father back in the first 5, 10, 15 years of marriage. We share those stories together. That's what you want. We live in this society that we change everything. We change jobs, we change houses, we change cars. You don't want to change partners. You want to be together till death do us part. You want to hand her to Jesus one day. And you want to hand him to Jesus.